Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today we're going to talk about Michael Shermer's fact-free attack on Expelled and Scientific American and how it exposes the intolerance of Darwinists towards pro-intelligent design scientists. Scientific American has a long history of opposing intelligent design, so it comes as no surprise that they have tasked their columnist, Michael Shermer, with the job of attacking the new movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. Michael Shermer is the founder of Skeptic Magazine, who loves to boast about how evolution liberated him from belief in God. In fact, he does just that in his article attacking Expelled, opening it by saying, quote, "In 1974, I matriculated at Pepperdine University as a born-again Christian who rejected Darwinism and evolutionary theory," unquote. But then when he, quote, "finally took a course in evolutionary biology in graduate school, I realized that I was hoodwinked," unquote. In his book, Why Darwin Matters, The Case Against Intelligent Design, Shermer tries to convince the reader that he believes that evolution and religion are compatible, but ultimately concedes that, quote, "were we to take a strictly scientific approach to the God question, we would have to reject the God hypothesis," unquote. In fact, it's tough to take Shermer's calls for peace between religion and Darwin seriously when he has elsewhere declared his view that, quote, "there is no God, intelligent designer, or anything resembling the divinity is preferred by the world's religions," unquote. Shermer is interviewed in the documentary Expelled, and he basically denies that there is any persecution of ID proponents going on. Since the film provides extensive documentation of the discrimination faced by ID proponents in the academy, Expelled disproves Shermer's one-sided skepticism. But Shermer's day job is literally being a professional skeptic. He makes a living telling people that they should be skeptical of religion. But Shermer virtually never applies his skepticism to modern evolutionary theory. This film shows that sometimes his skepticism against ID goes too far. Shermer certainly has a huge stake in the debate over this film. In fact, it seems that his entire worldview, livelihood, and deconversion experience depend heavily upon the veracity of Darwinian evolution. It therefore comes as no surprise that in his review of Expelled, he paints evolutionists as the saints and Darwinism as the pure and unadulterated religion. Shermer's general approach to handling persecution of ID proponents in his review of Expelled is one-sided skepticism, denial, and blaming the victim. Having seen Expelled, Shermer now knows that his denial that ID proponents get persecuted serves as a foil for the impressive documentation of such persecution presented throughout the film. His response is not to amend his answer in light of the facts presented in the movie, but rather to issue even more forceful denials that there is no persecution of ID proponents going on. Shermer's method of dealing with these persecution instances is as follows. 1. Ignore all the facts showing that there is persecution. 2. Email the persecutor and ask them if there was any anti-ID discrimination. 3. Withhold all skepticism from the statements of the persecutors and then trumpet their response as evidence that there is no persecution against ID proponents. Blaming the victim for losing their job and then claiming that those who feel there is persecution are just promoting a conspiracy. Shermer's record of consistently taking the side of the persecutors shows that he is part of the problem and is in no way an objective source to analyze the subject. For example, Shermer implies that Richard Sternberg's credibility is diminished because he's a fellow of the International Society for Complexity Information and Design, or because he is, quote, "a signature of Discovery Institute's 100 Scientists Who Doubt Darwinism statement," unquote. Of course, Shermer doesn't mention that it's over 700 scientists now, but the fact here is that Shermer shows that he himself could be a potential persecutor of Darwin skeptics because he's not interested in giving Darwin skeptics equal treatment. If only Shermer would turn some of his skepticism against the perpetrators instead of waging all of his skepticism against the victims. This is typical behavior of persecutors. Deny and blame the victim, telling them that they are merely conspiracy theorists. This unwillingness to believe the facts fits perfectly with Shermer's modus operandi, unyielding and eternal skepticism unless it supports Darwinism. Shermer's first case where he blames the victim is with Dr. Richard Sternberg. The conversation with Michael Shermer in the Expelled film revolves around the publication of Stephen C. Meyer's pro-ID peer-reviewed scientific article in the journal Proceedings for the Biological Society of Washington in 2004. The editor who oversaw the publication of that article was Dr. Richard Sternberg, who, according to investigations by both the U.S. Office of Special Counsel and also by subcommittee staff of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Government Reform, was subsequently harassed, intimidated, and demoted because he broke ranks with an unwritten rule among Darwinists that you must keep ID out of the journals. But here's the truth of the matter. Before Meyer's paper was published, the pro-Darwin lobby had long claimed that ID was not science because it was not in the peer-reviewed journals. But once ID was undeniably and explicitly supported in a peer-reviewed scientific journal article, the Darwinists panicked, and the National Center for Science Education, or NCSE, prompted the journal's publishing society, the Biological Society of Washington, or the BSW, to attack the paper. The BSW gladly obeyed the NCSE, issuing a statement that Meyer's paper should not have been published because ID allegedly is not science. If that doesn't sound like circular logic, consider the proof that the NCSE orchestrated the whole thing, according to the findings of the subcommittee staff investigation of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Government Reform. Quote, early on in the controversy, the NCSE circulated a set of talking points to the BSW Council and National Museum of Natural History officials on how to discredit both Sternberg and the Meyer article. The Office of Special Counsel Investigation found that the NCSE and recommendations were circulated within the Smithsonian Institution and eventually became part of the official public response of the Smithsonian Institution in the Meyer article, unquote. To attack Meyer's article, Shermer then cites the NCSE-inspired statement from the BSW, stating that, quote, contrary to typical editorial practices, the paper was published without review by any associate editor. Sternberg handled the entire review process. The council, which includes officers, elected counselors, and past presidents, and the associate editors would have deemed the paper inappropriate for the pages of the proceedings, unquote. Shermer should have applied some of his famous skepticism here, because that statement is in fact a falsehood. Eugenie Scott herself admitted that, quote, other editors have not always referred all the articles to associate editors, and because editors justifiably have discretion, unquote, that therefore the BSW should, quote, not come down too hard on Dr. Sternberg for his errors in the procedure in accepting this article, unquote. Shermer conveniently spares the BSW from skepticism over Eugenie Scott's behind-closed-doors concession, which contradicts the BSW's public statement. Moreover, Shermer and the BSW ignore the less politicized statements. Dr. Rory McDermott, the president of the BSW and a scientist at the Smithsonian, admitted that there was no wrongdoing regarding the peer review process of Meyer's paper, as he wrote, quote, I have seen the review file and comments from the three reviewers on the Meyer paper, all three with some differences among the comments recommended or suggested publication. I was surprised but concluded that there was not inappropriate behavior vis-a-vis the review process. Unquote. So the truth is that Meyer's paper was peer-reviewed, and the Darwinists have invented the claim that it was not peer-reviewed or that there was wrongdoing regarding the publication of the article. Shermer, the famous skeptic, seems unwilling to apply his skepticism to anything the Darwinists said about the situation, blindly accepting the denials from Darwinists that any discrimination against ID took place, instead blaming the victim. Shermer should just drop his attempts to defend the Smithsonian, but he doesn't, calling the attacks upon Sternberg part of Benstein's, quote, case for conspiracy, unquote. Let's review the findings of a congressional staff investigation to see if there really was any discrimination against Dr. Sternberg, or if Shermer was right, and this is all just a conspiracy inside the heads of Dr. Sternberg, Ben Stein, the U.S. Office of Special Counsel, and a bunch of people working at Congress. The congressional staff report found the following. Quote, officials at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History created a hostile work environment intended to force Dr. Sternberg to resign his position as a research associate in violation of his free speech and civil rights, unquote. As NMNH officials wrote in emails, quote, I think we could call Sternberg on the phone and verbally ask him to do the right thing and resign. Or, quote, a face-to-face meeting or at least a you're welcome to leave and resign call with this individual is in order, unquote. Or, quote, if Sternberg had any class, he would either entirely desist or resign his appointment, unquote. The report also found that, quote, in emails exchanged during August and September 2004, NMNH officials revealed their intent to use their government jobs to discriminate against scientists based upon their outside activities regarding evolution, unquote. As NMNH officials wrote in emails, quote, Sternberg is a well-established figure in anti-evolution circles, and a simple Google search would have exposed these connections, unquote. The report described a memo against Dr. Sternberg as follows. Quote, in a memo prepared on February 8, 2005, NMNH official Marilyn Schott admitted that after publication of the Meyer paper, Dr. Coddington wanted to know if Dr. Sternberg was religious. Dr. Schott further admitted telling Coddington that Sternberg was a Republican. Schott even conceded that Coddington may have asked her whether Sternberg was, quote, a fundamentalist and whether he was a conservative, unquote. The congressional staff report also found that, quote, NMNH officials conspired with a special interest group on government time and using government emails to publicly smear Dr. Sternberg. The group was also enlisted to monitor Sternberg's outside activities in order to find a way to dismiss him, unquote. As one NMNH official wrote in an email, quote, from now on, I will keep an eye on Dr. von Sternberg. I'd greatly like to know if you or other NCSE specialists could let me know about further activities by this gentleman in areas outside crustacean systematics, unquote. Michael Shermer apparently has unlimited skepticism when it comes to the claims of Darwin skeptics. He's unwilling to believe any of their statements that they have experienced persecution. But Dr. Sternberg summarized the discrimination taken against him as follows. Quote, I was transferred from the supervision of a friendly sponsor supervisor at the museum to a hostile one. I was twice forced to move specimens from my office space on short notice for no good reason, with my nameplate removed from my door, and eventually I was deprived of all official museum space and forced to use a shared work area as my museum work location. I was subjected to an array of new reporting requirements not imposed on any other research associates. My access to the specimens needed for my research at the museum was restricted. My access to the museum was also restricted. I was forced to give up my master key. Rather than admit that any of this evidence exists, Shermer happily applies infinite skepticism to the persecuted and withholds all skepticism from the statements of the persecutors. Shermer even emailed Jonathan Coddington, the chief persecutor of Richard Sternberg, asking him about the situation. It comes as no surprise that Dr. Coddington personally wrote back to Shermer, claiming that there was nothing to see here. In Coddington's words, quote, Sternberg was not discriminated against, he was never dismissed, and in fact, he was not even a paid employee, but just an unpaid research associate who had completed his three-year term, unquote. This is consistent with Coddington's prior behavior, as the Congressional Staff Investigations Report concluded, quote, given the factual record, the Smithsonian's pro forma denials of discrimination are unbelievable, unquote. So are Shermer's denials. And how did Eugenie Scott handle the situation? Unlike Coddington, Scott did not deny that Sternberg was ousted when she spoke to the Washington Post, but rather she admitted that there was an ousting of Sternberg and tried to justify it. Quote, said Eugenie Scott, the group's executive director, if this was a corporation and an employee did something that was really embarrassed the administration, really blew it, how long do you think that person would be employed? Scott of the NCSE insisted that Smithsonian scientists had no choice to explore Sternberg's religious beliefs. They don't care if you're religious, but they do care a lot if you are a creationist, Scott said. Sternberg denies it, but if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it argues for zealotry, unquote. So there you have it. What Jonathan Coddington denies, Eugenie Scott essentially admits and justifies because she thinks it's permissible to persecute and investigate someone if they sympathize with the creationists. If Michael Shermer should be skeptical of anything, it's the contradictory claims the Smithsonian and leading Darwinists like Eugenie Scott, which expose the attempts to cover up the unfair treatment of Dr. Sternberg. Thus we see Shermer's method of dismissing the discrimination of Darwin skeptics is as follows. 1. Ignore all the facts showing there was persecution. 2. Email the persecutor and ask them if there was any anti-ID discrimination. And 3. Withhold all skepticism from the statements of the persecutors and then trumpet their response as evidence that there is no persecution against ID proponents, blaming the victim for losing their job, and then claiming for that those who feel there was persecution are just promoting a, quote, conspiracy. While attacking Stephen Meyer's article in Proceedings for the Biological Society of Washington, Shermer briefly discusses the Cameron explosion, a major topic in Meyer's paper. Shermer states that the explosion is just an illusion because, quote, according to paleontologist Donald Prothero, in his 2007 magisterial book Evolution, What the Fossils Say and Why It Matters, quote, the major groups of invertebrate fossils do not appear suddenly at the base of the Cambrian, but are spaced out over strata spanning 80 million years, hardly an instantaneous explosion. Some groups appear tens of million years after the others, and preceding the Cambrian explosion was a long, slow buildup to the first appearance of typical Cambrian shelled invertebrates, unquote. Is that correct? Prothero's book is hard to take seriously, because as we shall see, it reads more like a polemic than a serious academic treatment. Consider these statements from Prothero's book. Quote, the creationist political pressure, propaganda, and liars are not restricted to public schools, unquote. Or, quote, if the fundamentalists continue to expand their political power, we are in for another inquisition, with the religious fanatics suppressing and destroying books and evidence and harassing anyone who doesn't agree with them, unquote. Or, quote, many scientists and authors have written how uplifting and liberating the scientific worldview can be for humankind, especially in comparison to the vengeful God of the Old Testament, unquote. Prothero's book is clearly one with an agenda that falls short of a calm, collected, objective scientific analysis. But if we want to understand the Cameron explosion, we have to turn to serious scientific treatments, not Prothero's polemic. So what do the textbooks say? A 2001 invertebrate zoology textbook that is a serious scientific textbook states, quote, most of the animal phyla that are represented in the fossil record appear fully formed in the Cambrian some 550 million years ago. The fossil record is therefore no help with respect to the origin and early diversification of the various animal phyla, unquote. In fact, Richard Dawkins conceded in 1986 regarding the Cambrian fauna that, quote, it is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history, unquote. In another very serious treatment of the subject, John Maynard Smith and Eeyore Sathmary, leaders in evolutionary biology, wrote in 1995 that, quote, the Cambrian explosion remains a puzzle, unquote, for Darwinian theorists, despite the discovery of a few pre-Cambrian fossils. Writing in The Major Transitions in Evolution, they say, quote, some 540 million years ago, at the beginning of the Cambrian, there appeared an array of multicellular marine animals, including the major phyla that exist today, cholenterates, platyhelminths, annelids, arthropods, mollusks, echinoderms, and others. Chordates are also present in the Cambrian, though they are not known from the earliest deposits, in which only hard parts are preserved, but are present in the slightly later Burgess Shale, in which soft-bodied forms are preserved. 40 years ago, this sudden appearance of metazoan fossils was not only a puzzle, but something of an embarrassment. The absence of any known fossils from earlier rocks was a weapon widely used by creationists. Today, the fossil evidence for the prokaryotes goes back 3,000 million years, and for protists, some 1,000 million years. The Cambrian explosion remains a puzzle, however, which has only been fitfully illuminated by the discovery of the enigmatic soft-bodied Ediacaran fauna, which still have a worldwide distribution between 580 and 560 million years ago. There are still doubts about how these fossils should be interpreted, unquote. It seems that Prothero has glossed over the real problems with evolutionary explanations of the Cambrian fauna in a book that hardly looks like a serious treatment of the subject. In the end, Shermer needs to apply some of his famous skepticism to his own sources. Shermer's second case of blaming the victim was with Dr. Guillermo Gonzalez, as Shermer blames pro-ID astronomer Guillermo Gonzalez for being denied tenure at Iowa State University, or ISU. But who is the expert that Shermer consults on this case? It's none other than Eugenie Scott, executive director of the National Center for Science Education. Scott had many complaints against Gonzalez's academic record, which I'll scrutinize one at a time. First, Scott claimed that while at ISU, Gonzalez's, quote, publication record tanked, unquote. But according to the Smithsonian NASA Astrophysics Data System, Gonzalez has published 34 publications since 2001, the year he joined ISU, and his normalized publication score is second among all astronomers in his department. As Rob Crowther has observed, quote, he peaks in 2003, but ends in 2006, just as high as he was when he started ISU. Moreover, he outperformed all ISU astronomy faculty in normalized publications during that period. The one year that is obviously yet less happens to be the same year that he co-authored an astronomy textbook published by Cambridge University Press. Not only that, but Gonzalez led astronomers in his department in normalized count of citations to his work in scientific papers. As noted, Gonzalez joined ISU in 2001, and for his publication since 2001, he has the highest normalized citation count of all astronomers in his department, including both tenured and untenured faculty. Moreover, despite the fact that he is much younger than many of the tenured faculty in his department, he has the second highest lifetime normalized citation count among all astronomers in his department. Given that Gonzalez apparently led all tenured ISU astronomers who voted against his tenure in both normalized publication count and normalized citation count since 2001, it's hard to see what grounds they have for complaining about his publication record. If Gonzalez's publication record did go down at all during his probationary period at ISU, it still remained at an extremely impressive level that warranted tenure. If anything, this indicates that scientists should not be penalized for extraordinarily high academic achievement rates earlier in their careers if, like Gonzalez, they continue to produce outstanding publication rates during their probationary tenure period. Next, Shermer quotes Eugenie Scott claiming that Gonzalez, quote, didn't have very many graduate students, and those he had never completed their degrees, unquote. This is a blatant falsehood, first promulgated by anti-ID groups in Iowa. As I explained to Iowa Citizens for Science when they made the same claim, quote, that statement is completely false. The truth is that in 2001, soon before Gonzalez left the University of Washington to join the faculty at ISU, he served as the primary advisor to a UW doctoral student in astronomy, Chris Laws. Gonzalez served as Laws' primary scientific advisor over the course of Laws' entire doctoral thesis, and Laws successfully graduated from UW with a PhD in astronomy in December 2004. Gonzalez also served on the committee of another PhD student at UW, Rory Barnes, and this student also successfully graduated in 2004, unquote. It's worth noting also that pre-tenure faculty typically are not expected to have as many graduate students as tenure faculty, because pre-tenured faculty are supposed to focus primarily on their own research. So even if Scott's complaints were accurate, they are of little relevance. Shermer should start applying some of his skepticism to the false claims of the pro-Darwin lobbyists like Eugenie Scott. Finally, Shermer asserts that Gonzalez lacks grants, but in their tenure guidelines, Dr. Gonzalez's department does not even list grants as a criterion they consider for gaining tenure. Nonetheless, Gonzalez was awarded a $50,000 grant from the Discovery Institute that allows him to collect more than enough observational astronomy data each year for the next 5 years to conduct a successful research program. In short, Dr. Gonzalez has precisely the money he needs to have a successful research program at ISU. So if Gonzalez's department doesn't list grants as a requirement for tenure, what do the guidelines state? They state, quote, for promotion to associate professor, excellence sufficient to lead to a national or international reputation is required and would ordinarily be shown by the publication of approximately 15 papers of good quality in refereed journals, unquote. In that regard, Dr. Gonzalez has over 350% more peer-reviewed science articles than what his department ordinarily requires for indicating the type of reputation that demonstrates research excellence. Having observed this, one external reviewer summarized Dr. Gonzalez's case for tenure as follows, quote, Dr. Gonzalez is eminently qualified for the promotion according to your guidelines of excellence in scholarship and exhibiting a potential for national distinction. In light of your criteria, I would certainly recommend the promotion, unquote. Indeed, two-thirds of the external reviewers who gave an opinion about whether Dr. Gonzalez deserved tenure agreed that he should receive tenure. Shermer ignores these accomplishments of Dr. Gonzalez and instead continues his usual method of quoting the persecutor in their denials of discrimination as if that settles the case. Thus, Shermer writes, quote, according to Gregory Joffre, president of Iowa State, over the past 10 years, four of the 12 candidates who came up for review in the physics and astronomy department were not granted tenure, unquote. But that is irrelevant, for Shermer forgets that Gonzalez's academic achievements, whether good or bad, do nothing to negate the undeniable evidence of bias and prejudice against him in his department because he supports ID. For example, ISU physicist John Hauptmann explicitly admitted in an op-ed that he voted against Gonzalez's tenure because of ID, writing, quote, I participated in the initial vote and voted no based on this fundamental question, what is science, unquote. Hauptmann goes on to oppose ID and writes, quote, it is purely a question of what is science and what is not, and a physics department is not obligated to support notions that do not even begin to meet scientific standards, unquote. Moreover, during tenure deliberations in November 2006, Dr. Gonzalez's department chair, Eli Rosenberg, devoted a full third of his chair's statement in Gonzalez's tenure file to discussing intelligent design, instructing voting members on ISU's Department of Physics and Astronomy to make ID a litmus test where Gonzalez's support for ID as science, quote, disqualifies him from serving as a science educator, unquote. In the summer of 2005, atheist professor of religion at ISU, Hector Avalos, emailed ISU faculty, calling on, quote, all faculty members, unquote, to reject efforts to, quote, portray intelligent design as science because of the, quote, negative impact due to the fact that intelligent design has, quote, now established a presence at Iowa State University, unquote. ISU physicist George Schmalian endorsed a plan to release an anti-ID statement from the Department of Physics and Astronomy intending to send a message to Dr. Gonzalez. He wrote, quote, if we go on record, we give Gonzalez a clear sign that his ID efforts will not be considered as science by the faculty, unquote. Other faculty endorsed such statements from Schmalian with an intent to directly target Gonzalez, with another scientist in Gonzalez's department stating that ISU, quote, is not a friendly place for him to develop further his ideas, unquote, capital ID, of course. Additionally, two tenure-voting faculty in Gonzalez's department had links to an NCSE anti-ID petition publicly denouncing intelligent design as, quote, creationist pseudoscience, unquote. Finally, ISU physicist Bruce Harmon said in an email, quote, as George Schmalian says, I think that Gonzalez should know that some faculty in his department are not going to count his ID work as a plus for tenure. Quite the opposite, unquote. It seems clear that ID did play a major negative and inappropriate role in Gonzalez's tenure denial. Shermer ignores all of this evidence, finding ways to ignore inconvenient facts make it clear what really happened at ISU. In his one-sided skepticism, he is skeptical only of the claims of ID proponents and never doubts the demonstrably false claims of Eugenie Scott. Readers can decide for themselves whether Shermer and ISU are correct to claim that ID played no significant role in Gonzalez's denial of tenure. But what does Scott's organization, the NCSC, have to say about Gonzalez and intelligent design and tenure? In fact, the NCSC has now sponsored an anti-expelled website called Expelled Exposed that takes an intolerant mindset that justifies discriminating against Gonzalez simply because he supports ID. The Expelled Exposed site says that Gonzalez is, quote, distracting work on an unscientific enterprise like intelligent design, unquote. Among other things, quote, makes it impossible for supporters to legitimately claim the decision not to grant him tenure was unfounded, unquote. In fact, when discussing Gonzalez, the NCSE website explicitly argues that ID proponents do not deserve the protection of academic freedom, stating that, quote, a scientist should not expect his colleagues to ignore his advocacy of a perspective that those in his field have overwhelmingly rejected, unquote. In other words, when ID proponents like Gonzalez come up for tenure, the NCSE thinks that ID should count as an automatic and absolute negative. Clearly, the NCSE endorses discriminating against Gonzalez simply because he supports ID. We have seen clear evidence that Gonzalez's Darwinist colleagues at ISU felt exactly the same. Yet Gonzalez's work on ID has clear academic legitimacy that deserves the protection of academic freedom. Indeed, the ISU faculty handbook states that academic freedom is, quote, the foundation of the university, unquote. It must be noted that Gonzalez never even taught ID in the classroom, but his book on ID, The Privileged Planet, was written using a grant from the prestigious Templeton Foundation, a grant which ISU accepted. Moreover, leading scientists such as Simon Connolly Morris, Owen Gingrich, and Philip Skell all praised his book on ID. His book was even favorably reviewed by David Hughes of the Royal Astronomical Society. Even if some ISU faculty disagree with Gonzalez's views on intelligent design, his work clearly has academic legitimacy that deserves the protection of academic freedom. Gonzalez's tenure debate has never been, as Lori Lebo suggested it is in Skeptic magazine, a case where we have argued that, quote, it is unfair to take intelligent design into consideration, unquote, during tenure. Intelligent design can be considered during tenure evaluations. The question is, how should faculty respond to it? Will they count ID as an automatic and absolute negative, as the NCSC suggests they should? Or will they consider the possibility that a commitment to true academic freedom requires that scientists be granted the right to hold such minority scientific viewpoints? Scientists have every right to dissent from ID and express their views in disagreement with intelligent design. The relevant question here is, however, will scientists be given the right to support intelligent design? The NCSE unambiguously suggests that the answer to that question is no. But as noted, the ISU faculty handbook claims that academic freedom is, quote, the foundation of the university, unquote. ISU faculty and Gonzalez's department chose to follow the NCSE's approach, counting Gonzalez's support for ID as a pure negative, failing to grant academic freedom for minority dissenting scientific viewpoints that clearly have academic respectability. But academic freedom doesn't just give scientists the rights to agree with majority scientific viewpoint. If Lori Lebo and the NCSE had their way, ID proponents would be dismissed simply because they support ID, taking away any real academic freedom to hold such a minority scientific viewpoint. Shermer quotes extensively from NCSE Executive Director Eugenie Scott regarding Gonzalez's case, clearly showing that he is only taking the side of the persecutors, never supporting the persecuted. Hypocritically, Eugenie Scott also says that Ben Stein should not try to define science because, quote, none of us speak for science, unquote. But that's highly hypocritical for her to suggest, because she blessed Judge Jones, a non-scientist, in his efforts to define science in the Kitzmiller ruling, and she constantly purports to speak for science. In an article she wrote entitled Science, Religion, and Evolution, she wrote, quote, science restricts itself to explaining the natural world using natural causes, unquote. And who does she cite to justify her definition of science? She cites herself. Eugenie Scott clearly thinks that she can speak for science. She just doesn't like it when other people have opinions about science that differ from her own. This sounds like a familiar theme among the Darwinists who are interviewed and expelled. In conclusion, what else does Shermer have to say? Shermer conspicuously does not dispute the admissions by Darwinists in the film that scientists lack a natural chemical explanation for the origin of life. But Shermer claims that there is no persecution because some critics of natural selection, like Lynn Margulis or William Schaff, are embraced by the scientific community. But these critics are fully within the mainstream Darwinian mindset. They wholly reject intelligent design, and they believe that unguided processes built all of life's complexity. So they don't threaten the core of neo-Darwinism, making it unsurprising that Shermer finds they have experienced no persecution. In the end, what does Shermer really have to say against this movie? He calls the film, quote, dishonest because some Pepperdine biology professors complained that it brought in students as extras for a scene where Ben Stein gives a speech to students. A movie that used extras? Shocking. If Michael Shermer should learn anything from this episode, it is this. Rather than levying unrestrained skepticism against anything that challenges Darwin, he should start using some of the skepticism that made him famous upon the claims of people on his own side in this debate. This is Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast signing off. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID of the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID of the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID of the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.